The fort received a shock when Lewis Renfrew arrived with his alert wife Daisy, for the traditional desk hog was apt to be an obese, slovenly fellow with little military bearing. Renfrew was quite the opposite, a 36-year-old West Point man from a good family in Ohio, tall, erect, 10 pounds underweight from daily horsemanship in the parks of Washington, and a man determined to give a good account of himself on the frontier. He would take Miner's place as head of Company S, 10th Cavalry, under the command of Captain Reed, to whom he said unctuously, "I want you to rely on me as one of the best officers you've ever had. When you give me an order, consider it executed." Fawningly eager to create a good impression, he sought out Captain Wetzel and assured him, "I'll not permit any ridiculous cavalry infantry unpleasantness while I command the Buffalo soldiers. They'll be disciplined." But that same day he implied quite the opposite to Jaxifer, to whom he told an outright lie concerning his experiences in the war. "I served with Negro troops on 3 different occasions. None better. If the infantry give you any trouble, you'll find me on your side all the way." But despite this trickery in fort politics, whenever an expedition against the Indians was organized, he wanted to be in the lead. And from that position, he gave a good account of himself. "He knows how to fight," Sergeant Jaxifer told his troopers. "We got a good man this time." This was a sensible estimation, because when an energetic foray led by Renfrew ran into outriders of the main Comanche force, a bitter running battle ensued. 40 Indians on mounts of superior speed against 19 cavalrymen with superior firepower. Neither side could claim a victory, but Renfrew pursued the Indians with such vigor that any Comanche whose horse faltered even slightly was overtaken and shot. Renfrew was always in the lead, probably the best single horseman on the field that day, and when the chase was over, the black soldiers were satisfied that they had gained a proficient leader. In a second fray, when Reed was in command, Renfrew accepted his subordinate position graciously and moved his contingent instantly when Reed signaled. He was a good officer, and Reed told Wetzel, "Had he stayed out here with us instead of hiding in Washington, he could have been one of Sherman's young colonels." And the German agreed that Renfrew was first class. "I think his name must be German," Wetzel said. "He carries himself so well." But Lewis Renfrew had no intention of laboring on the frontier to establish his reputation as the fourth of the young colonels. He would perform impeccably with the troops, but he would also pull every string to get back to his desk job in Washington. Bypassing established channels, he and his wife bombarded everyone in real command with clever petitions, and were assured, "As soon as anything interesting happens, back you'll come." What the incident might be, the Renfrews could not guess, but their hammering at the doors of preferment became so well known that Mrs. Reed felt she had to caution Daisy against her excesses, and in the room where so many had been quietly reprimanded, Daisy now took her place. But she proved to be quite different from her predecessors. "Do you not see that your actions may be prejudicing your husband's chances?" Louise Reed asked. "I am improving them. Louis was born to serve in Washington, and I shall do my best to see that he does so." "But he is so capable at the front, he could be one of the great leaders." "He's already one of the great leaders, Mrs. Reed. He fights in Washington with a skill that not even Sherman and Sheridan could exhibit. But the real fighting is out here, against the Indians." "Half of it is," Daisy replied. "And I do believe that the more important half, in peacetime, is back with us, fighting the battles in Congress." "But look at this fort, Mrs. Renfrew. Does not the building of an establishment like this mean anything to you? When my husband came here, not a post erected, not a wall in place. He built a mud fort, and when the dead house is finished, it will all be stone, a permanent testimony to the brave men who occupied it." Mrs. Renfrew had to laugh. "One act of Congress, and this fort vanishes, back to the Mesquite. It's in Congress where the peacetime army fights its battles, and Lewis is going back to work with Congress, where he can do some good." Mrs. Reed had to be blunt. "Mrs. Renfrew, You certainly must be aware that your husband's report will be written by my husband. Why are you so daring in disregarding my counsel? I do not disregard it, and I'm sure Louis doesn't disregard your husband's. What can possibly be reported except that Louis was foremost in battle, striking in his courage, and immediately responsive to orders? Yes, yes. We both try to be like that. Haven't you seen that if you even hint at an instruction, I comply? But I am now more than hinting that you should stop these letters. Now it was Daisy's turn to be obdurate. That's quite a different matter, dealing with the welfare of the entire army, not with a single fort. Louis can aid immensely in getting our army the funds it needs, the support it requires. Of course I shall continue to help him get the post he deserves. The interview ended poorly, with battle lines drawn and animosities flaring. But the impasse did not continue long, because the kind of incident which the Renfro adherents in Washington needed to bring their man back home occurred, with an incandescent explosion that not even the most stalwart Renfro supporter could have anticipated. During the hottest part of the summer of 1874, Renfro, Jaxifer, and all the effectives of Company S, 47 in number, set forth on the supposed trail of Chief Muttark, whose braves had spent that summer ravaging the ranches along the frontier. The Texas government had warned settlers not to venture too far west, and the United States government had explained that protection, even from forts like Richardson and Garner, could not ensure safety. But the insatiable hunger for land which would always characterize Texans lured the adventurers farther and farther west. Just as the four Larkin brothers had dared the empty plains, claiming their 6,000 acres and holding them nicely until the Comanche struck, so now other daring men and women staked out their claims beyond the forts. And during this summer alone, 60 white men, women, and children had been slain, usually in a manner so brutal and horrifying as to shock even those Texans who had become accustomed to the barbarisms. After the annihilation of four ranch families well to the south and west of Fort Garner, Renfro sought permission to make a major sortie, and with innate cleverness, he did not ride directly south to where the crimes had occurred, but in a contrary direction, far to the west toward the Palo Duro Canyon and the extreme limits of the Indian territory. For he reasoned that the triumphant Indians would have sped away from the burning ranches, then taken their time to head for sanctuary. He was right. He and his men attacked the celebrating Comanche from the north, sweeping down on them in a sudden shattering attack. And because newspapers throughout the nation gave much space to what happened next, it is essential that the exact details be understood. With Renfro in the lead, the 10th Cavalry launched a major attack, and, according to plan, at the height of battle, half the troops swung west under Renfro, half to the east under Jaxifer. Renfro and his men performed with signal valor, everyone testified to that, and by tremendous exertion turned the flank of the advancing Comanche, throwing the rest of the Indians into confusion. When this occurred, Sergeant Jaxifer on the east saw a chance to sweep in and disrupt the Comanche completely, and he did this. But as his men galloped through the Indian ranks, he caught sight of what he believed to be a white girl, and the idea flashed through his mind, that must be the Larkin child. Reacting more to instinct than to conscious plan, he wheeled his horse and pursued that group of Indians who held the girl. Alone and threatened by dozens of braves, he plunged on, overtook the fleeing Indians, reached out, and miraculously snatched the girl from her captors, clubbing with his gun the head of the brave who had been holding her. Turning once more, he broke through the confused Indians to a point where his astonished black troops could give him coverage, and for some moments a violent struggle ensued. But with the girl in his arms, Jaxifer rallied his men until they prevailed. At this moment, Renfro galloped up, saw the girl, and perceived at once her magical significance. Taking her gently from the sergeant, he held her close and asked, "You are Emma Larkin?" And she replied, with full knowledge of what her words meant, "I am." Thus the legend was born. Louis Renfro, in an attack upon the savage Comanche, when his men were outnumbered 100-49, had recovered the white child Emma Larkin, whose family had been murdered at Bear Creek in 1869, and who had been captive of the savages for 5 long years. Stories were written in such a way as to indicate that Renfro's feat was the more astonishing, in that he was supported only by Negro troops, whose effectiveness in such warfare was not proved. Apparently, it was his heroic persistence that had made the rescue possible. The story proved wildly popular, with Harper's and the New York newspapers sending artists to Texas to depict the battle and the manner of Emma's rescue. Pictures proliferated, but they all faced 2 difficulties. It was not practical to show black troops at the scene, so faces were blurred, except for Lieutenant Renfro's. And the fact that Emma had no nose or ears meant that she could not be shown either, which meant that Renfro pretty well stole the show. In fact, on 2 occasions when the press were permitted to see Emma, some of the men vomited, and quite a few of their stories said merely that she had been poorly treated by her captors. And even those 2 or 3 reporters who did mention the mutilations did not speak of the rapes. Americans, then as later, wanted their stories heroic, but also respectful of the niceties. More than 2 dozen detailed interviews spelled out Renfro's heroism and audacity. No one questioned Jaxifer. At one point, Emma told a woman reporter the facts. But when this woman searched out Jaxifer, she was frightened by his bigness, his lack of a neck, and his thick lips. So his part in the rescue was ignored. This was the incident that Daisy Renfro needed to get her man back to Washington, and she orchestrated the affair skillfully. She sought a congratulatory telegram from Colonel Custer, and tender stories from other Texas settlers, who said they wished that Lieutenant Renfro would rescue their lost children from Matak. Before the month was out, Washington was clamoring for its newest hero to return. And when Daisy and Lewis left Fort Garner, they took care to ensure that both Captain and Mrs. Reed received credit for the fine manner in which the fort had been administered. Said Renfro to the press, "You cannot have brave soldiers at a lonely frontier unless you have a fine commander in charge of them. Than Captain Reed, there can be no finer." When the train pulled out of the station at New Orleans, he told his wife, "We'll never see Texas again. What a desolate land." Emma Larkin, a 12-year-old captive of the Comanche, had been a kind of holy grail of the plains, with all decent men striving to rescue her, a challenge that would not dissipate even with the passage of years. But Emma Larkin, a 17-year-old young woman aged beyond her years, was an embarrassment, and after the first flush of her victorious recapture, no one knew what to do with her. The women at the fort, of course, had rejoiced at her return, but quickly they realized that there was no place for her in their lives, nor anywhere else for that matter. For one thing, she had no family, all of her immediate relatives having been exterminated at Bear Creek, and possible ones back east having been lost in the normal experiences of immigration. But more important, she was hideously ugly, a frail, stringy girl with almost no bosom, and those terrible scars where her ears and nose should have been. Furthermore, she had formed the habit of speaking in a whisper, so that she often seemed like a ghost wandering in from another world. And after a few days of compassion, no one wanted to have her around. Mrs. Reed did take it upon herself to represent the girl's interests in the land court at Jacksboro, for it was clear that Emma must have inherited all the lands once owned by her father and her uncles. Rapacious men had tried to obtain squatters' rights on the 6,000 acres when no surviving Larkin stepped forward to claim them. But it was apparent that if poor Emma had experienced such tortures, the least society could do was return her patrimony. As always, when Texas land was involved, the fight became vicious, and Mrs. Reed was advised to withdraw lest she endanger the good community relationship with the fort. And she would have done so had she not obtained unintended support from Earnshaw Rusk up at Camp Hope. Rusk now had Matark's fleeing Comanche living peacefully on his grounds, and they had many complaints against Captain Reed and his soldiers. "This man Renfro, he attacked us when we were hunting buffalo. We were doing nothing but hunting, and his buffalo soldiers charged upon us and killed our braves. He also stole one of our women. This latter charge, delivered with much excitement and waving of arms, electrified Rusk, for it represented exactly the kind of army behavior that he was determined to stamp out. So, on a clear day at the end of summer 1874, he and two of his Comanche assistants rode the 58 miles south to Fort Garner to lodge an official protest. But before departing, he thought it prudent to inform his superiors in the Interior Department of what he was about, lest contrary reports filter in from the fort. "At last I have a foolproof case against the army at Fort Garner, and I intend to pursue it vigorously. In August of this year, when my Comanche, under the peaceful guidance of Chief Matark, about whom I have written before, were trailing buffalo, they did, I must admit, stray into Texas territory. But they were behaving like the good citizens I have taught them to be when they were fallen upon by Colonel Renfro and a horde of his cavalrymen. Several braves were slain, and an Indian woman was taken from them. I hold this to be a gross infraction of the rules which govern this area, and I shall go personally to Fort Garner to seek redress for my Indians. I am leaving Camp Hope in the hands of Chief Matark during my absence, which ought not be prolonged, but I assure thee that I shall speak harshly to the army." When the righteous Quaker appeared at the fort, Wetzel wanted to arrest the two Comanche braves, but Rusk made such a howl that Reed had to promise safe passage, as the peace policy required. The discussions continued as before, with Rusk insisting upon the peaceful intentions of his Indians, and Reed enumerating the hideous roster of Texas ranches burned and Texas ranchers slain. None of these charges, which seemed so specific to the army men, would Rusk accept as proof of Comanche guilt. Instead, he launched vigorous protest against army brutality, and there the debate hung suspended, with each man accusing the other of duplicity and moral blindness. "Can't you see, Rusk, that your beloved Indians are a gang of murderers who should be shot? Can't thee see, Captain Reed, that thy men are a gang of undisciplined bullies who love to harass my Indians? What about the murders at the 17 ranches I've listed? What about your men kidnapping one of my Indian women?" Reed stopped and gaped at the Quaker. "You don't know who that woman was? Then thee admits the kidnapping?" Reed almost laughed. "Everyone in the world knows who she is. But you live a few miles to the north, and you haven't heard? Rusk, are you truly innocent, or are you stupid? I expect to be abused at your hands, but I also expect—" "Louise," Reed shouted, "ask Bertha Wetzel to bring the girl here." As might have been expected, Mrs. Wetzel, the practical frontier woman, had given the unwanted girl a temporary home, and now she grasped Emma's hand and brought her to the commander's office. Mrs. Wetzel entered the room first, with the girl lagging behind, so that Rusk could not see who was coming. But when the pair were well inside, Mrs. Wetzel stepped aside, and Emma Larkin stood revealed. With the ability she had acquired to suffer anything, she kept her chin high and looked right at Earnshaw Rusk, and when he saw her, he gasped. Trying to speak, he could not, and for a long moment these two stared at each other, the near-crazed child of torture and the near-godlike believer in the goodness of man. When the moment passed, Rusk stepped boldly to the girl and put his arms about her. "Jesus Christ has thee in his heart." He tried to say more, but he could not. And after a moment most embarrassing to Reed, Mrs. Wetzel, and even the girl, he bowed his head, and quiet tears welled in his eyes. He was so shaken that he had to sit down, and as he huddled there, his world falling apart, Reed said with less severity than he had intended, "This is Emma Larkin, sole survivor of Bear Creek, prisoner of your Comanche for 5 years." Slowly, Rusk regained his feet, staring in anguish first at Reed, then at Mrs. Wetzel. "Is this truly the Larkin child?" "It is," Reed said, "and I want you to hear her story, every word of it, without my presence or Mrs. Wetzel's. Come, Bertha," and he led her away. "Sit down with me," Rusk said when they were gone. And in the stone-walled office, built with such care under the supervision of Mrs. Reed, began the conversation which would change so much along the Red River. Earnshaw, "Is thee really Emma Larkin?" Emma, in her soft whisper, "I am. I remember my family, all 15. Do you want me to name them?" Earnshaw, "And thee was present at Bear Creek?" Emma, "This is Bear Creek. This is where it happened. My father and my brothers were killed in our house not far from here." Earnshaw, "And thee is sure Indians did it?" Emma, "They took me captive, didn't they?" Earnshaw, "But was it Matark?" Emma, "I have lived with Matark for 4 summers. Matark's sons." Earnshaw, "Thy ears?" Emma, "His sons burned them off slowly, night after night." Earnshaw, "That I cannot believe." Emma, "Look at them." Earnshaw, "Thy nose?" Emma, "They would take embers from the fire and dance around me, then jab the embers against my nose. And when the scab formed..." Earnshaw, "Please." Fearing for a moment that he was going to be sick, he changed the subject. "Did they beat thee?" Emma, "Especially the women." Earnshaw, "The men?" Emma, "They came at night to sleep with me." Such a statement embarrassed Rusk so profoundly that once more he stopped the conversation. He had never kissed a woman and deemed their behavior a great mystery. Earnshaw, "Thee mustn't speak of such things. Thee must forget them." Emma, "I've tried to. It's you who asked the questions." Earnshaw, "Did no one ever treat thee kindly?" Emma, after a prolonged reflection, "No one. But there was a white man with a lame left arm. They called him Little Brother because he sold them guns. I think his name was Peavine." Earnshaw, "He was with them?" Emma, "Often. They told him what they needed, and he went back and stole it." Earnshaw, "Did thee ever hear them call him Rattlesnake?" Emma, "No, but things were always better for me when he came, because he brought guns and other things, and for a while they forgot me." She weighed her next comment carefully. "He always took me aside and promised that one day I would be set free. I dreamed about that day, but it never happened." Earnshaw, "This man, thee is sure he had a weak left arm?" Emma, "They also called him Little Cripple." Since both spoke Comanche, she could report precisely what the Indians had called their Comanchero. "He never beat me or abused me. One time Chief Matark said, and I heard him say it, 'You can sleep with the thing if you wish.' But Peavine said, 'I do not wish.' And that night I was left alone." Earnshaw, "Did thee ever ride with the Comanche when they came down into Texas?" Emma, "Many times." Earnshaw, "And did thy Indians burn ranches in Texas?" Emma, "Like here at Bear Creek, many times." Earnshaw, "But that was long ago, I'm sure." Emma, "It was 1 moon ago, when the black soldiers captured me." Earnshaw, "Thee was hunting buffalo that time. I know thee was hunting buffalo." Emma, "We had all the buffalo we needed north of the river. We came into Texas to burn and kill." Earnshaw, weakly, "Thee means, thy Comanche planned it that way? Strike south, then run back north?" Emma, "Why not? Those were the rules. You made them, we obeyed them." She spoke these sentences in Comanche, which gave them a lilting, arrogant echo, which cut so deeply at Rusk's integrity that he shuddered. Earnshaw, "What will thee do now?" Emma, "I know nothing." She said this with such simplicity, such willingness to throw herself upon the mercy of God, that he was awed. Earnshaw, "Surely thee has friends. Thee must have family." Emma, "I have no one. I am not like others." Earnshaw, "Thee has the love of Jesus Christ, and thee can be like others. Thee can wear thy hair about thy ears, and no one will see, Emma, but this? Earnshaw, and thee can make thyself a nose. I'm not sure how right now, but I know it can be done. He spoke with great force. We will make thee a nose. We will make thee friends. Emma, who would want me as a friend? You know I had a baby. Earnshaw, good God. He stalked about the room. Good God, thee hasn't told anyone, has thee? Emma, nobody asked. Earnshaw, thee had a child? Emma, mine moon period came. Like the others, I had a child. Earnshaw, totally disoriented. Thee must not speak of this, not to anyone. Then, overcoming his embarrassment, he regained courage. Thee means, the Indian men, they? Emma, I told you they came to my bed at night, one after another. At this appalling news, which he had not fully comprehended before, Rusk drew away from the girl, a fact which she noticed and accepted. I'm sorry I told you, Mr. Rusk. Earnshaw, thee knows my name? Emma, we all knew your name. The man who lets us do anything, they called you. Earnshaw, why did I never see thee at Camp Hope? Emma, they never brought us captives. Earnshaw, there are others? Emma, each tribe has many. They trade us back and forth. Earnshaw, always children? Always little girls? Emma, the men they kill, always. Grown women they keep alive for a while, use them, kill them. The boys they train as young braves. They become Indians. The girls they use, like me. Earnshaw, oh, my God, what have I done? Emma, my child was a boy. I do not want him. Earnshaw, but if he's thy child? Emma, I did not want him then. I do not want him now. I want to forget them all. Earnshaw, does thee know what prayer is? Emma, we prayed here at Bear Creek. I prayed that I'd be rescued some day. Earnshaw, will thee pray with me now? She dropped to her knees, but Rusk caught her by the arm, the first time he had touched her, and brought her upright. I am a Quaker, and we do not feel the necessity of kneeling. We speak to God direct. So the two casualties of the frontier prayed that God would give bewildered Earnshaw Rusk guidance to rectify the errors he had fostered, and that assistance would be provided Emma Larkin in the fearsome decisions she must make. He ended the prayer with the hope that Emma would find in her heart renewed love for her baby boy. But when the prayer ended, she told him bluntly, "The child is gone. It is all gone." When he returned to Camp Hope, Earnshaw Rusk assembled his Comanche and berated them as never before. "Thee has lied to me. Thee has crossed the Red River not in the chase of buffalo, but to burn and kill. And thee keeps hidden from me other children like Emma Larkin, and such behavior must stop." Matark said boldly, "We will go where we wish, and we will give them the children when they offer enough money. Thee hides the man called Rattlesnake Peavine in thy ranks, and he is wanted for many murders. He is our friend. We will always protect him from the army." Astonished by the boldness of the Comanche, Rusk pleaded with them to make an honest peace with the army and refrain from any further raids into Texas. "Noble Chief Matark, I promise thee that even now it is not too late. If thee and I ride to Fort Garner and enter into solemn promises..." "No Indian can trust their promises. They kill our buffalo. They ravage our camps." "Up to now, yes, it's been warfare. But warfare always ends, and peace brings consolations." He was speaking in Comanche, most eloquently, depicting the longed-for solution to the Indian problem. And tears came to his eyes as he pleaded, "Great Chief Matark, the grandest thing you could give your people, the gift that would make your name sing across the plains, peace. A final agreement to stay north of the Red River, an agreement to live a new life here on the vast reservations the Great White Father has promised thee." They are big now, Matark said with exceptional insight. But they will become very small when your people want them back. If we ride south, Rusk said imploringly, even now we can arrange a peace in which all past raids will be forgiven. Thee will return the stolen children, and thee will live here happily with me. We cannot trust you. Please, please, the Quaker pleaded, listen to reason. For the love of God and the safety of thy own children, ride with me and let us make peace. Matark's response was hideous. Enlisting more than 100 chanting braves, he led them deep into Texas, where they burned 6 isolated ranches, killing the men with customary tortures, and running off with 7 additional children. After they crept back to sanctuary at Camp Hope, he actually boasted in the presence of the agent, "We taught the Texans a lesson," and with insulting belligerence, he refused to surrender the children, asking Rusk, "And what are you going to do about it?" Now a bizarre chain of frontier incidents occurred. To the astonishment of Captain Reed at Fort Garner, Earnshaw Rusk rode south unattended and humiliated himself in the stone-walled headquarters. I was deluded. I was lied to. Chief Matark is a dreadful killer who keeps numerous white children in his camps. My way was wrong. I ask thee, Captain Reed, to send thy troops into the Indian territory and arrest this brutal man. Is this a formal request, Agent Rusk? It is. You know that your superiors at Fort Sill and Washington... I know they will be disgusted with me, going against our agreement, but even for a Quaker the time comes when crime must be punished. I will have to have this in writing, Mr. Rusk. And thee shall. Sitting at the captain's desk, he penned a formal request for United States troops to invade Camp Hope in the Indian Territory and there to arrest Chief Matark of the Comanche for crimes innumerable. When he signed this document, which negated a lifetime of religious training and abrogated his promises to President Grant, his hands trembled. But it was done. And then he surprised the soldiers by asking if he could see the girl Emma Larkin, for he had brought her something. More or less in hiding, she was still living with the Wetzels, who were beginning to see in her a sensitive human being with the merits of courage, forthrightness, and a surprising sense of humor as she went about the housework which the German family assigned her. When Mrs. Wetzel brought her before Agent Rusk, she noticed that the girl actually seemed happy to see him. And he said, "No, Mrs. Wetzel, thee must stay. I need thy help." He took from his pocket a carefully carved wooden nose to which was attached 2 lengths of braided horsehair. And with Emma standing by a window, he placed the nose in the middle of her face and asked Mrs. Wetzel to hold it firm while he tied the horsehair braids behind the back of Emma's head. "Oh," Mrs. Wetzel cried with real joy, "now you have a nose." And she hurried for her mirror, and when the girl saw the transformation that had occurred, she could only look first at Rusk, then at Mrs. Wetzel, and then back at the mirror. Finally, she put the mirror down and took Mrs. Wetzel's hands, which she kissed. Then she did the same with Rusk. But as soon as she had done this, she grabbed the mirror again and studied herself. And as she did so, Rusk reached out and pulled strands of her hair across the stumps of her ears. And when she saw herself whole again, she did not burst into tears of gratitude. She jumped straight up in the air and gave a startling Comanche yell. "I am Emma Larkin. I am Emma Larkin." But she was not allowed to keep her nose, because Mrs. Wetzel took it from her and left the room. When she returned, she had replaced the horsehair braid with an almost invisible white thread. And now, when Emma looked in the mirror that Mrs. Wetzel held for her, neither she nor anyone else could detect that it was the thread which held the wooden nose in place. And seeing this perfection, and realizing what it meant, an invitation back into life, she wept. The men at Fort Garner lost little time in mounting a massive attack on Camp Hope, and although other Quaker commissioners at posts in the Indian Territory tried to halt this breach of the peace policy, officers waved Agent Rusk's written request at them and plunged ahead. In a series of daring moves, they caught Matark and three of his principal supporters. They also captured 9 white children, whose stories inflamed the frontier so much that the court in Jacksboro sentenced Matark and his men to hanging. However, the Quakers were not powerless, and they stormed into federal courts, getting not only injunctions against the hanging, but also an agreement whereby Matark and his men would be assigned temporarily to a low-security Texas prison. They were there only a few months when another court set them free, on the theory that they had learned their lesson and would henceforth be reliable citizens. A month after their return to Camp Hope, they broke loose and raided savagely along the Texas frontier, burning and torturing as before. The response from Washington was swift. Gentle-hearted Benjamin Grierson would remain at regimental headquarters in Fort Sill to make way for a real fighting man, Reynold McKenzie, who was brought in to lead one of 5 converging columns which would bear down on any Indians found outside their reservations. They would come at Matark and his killers from Texas, New Mexico, Arkansas, and the Indian Territory, with Colonel Nelson Miles leading the force opposite to McKenzie's. These 2 fiery colonels would form the jaws of a nutcracker in which the enemy would be caught. When grim-lipped McKenzie set out after Matark, Reed insisted on leading the 3-company detachment from Fort Garner, with Wetzel left behind to defend the place with 1 company of infantry. As bad luck would have it, the Garner contingent found itself facing the most difficult part of the terrain, that series of smaller canyons which protected Palo Duro on the south, and Jaxifer told his men, "Seem like we march 1 mile down into the canyon, then 1 mile back up to make 0.5 mile forward." McKenzie, observing the brutal terrain the Buffalo soldiers were struggling with, commended them. "You men are fighting your battle before the battle begins." Nevertheless, he told Jaxifer, "Hurry them up." The excessive heat was a more serious matter, for this was early September, when the plains of Texas blazed their hottest. Many a newcomer to the state moaned during his first August, "Well, at least September will soon be here." But he was remembering September in New Hampshire or New York. When the Texas September struck, he shuddered. In 1874, September was exceptionally hot, with the entire surface of the panhandle becoming a mirage, dancing insultingly along the horizon. Mesquite trees huddled, scorched by the sun, drawing into their limitless roots what little water they found deep down. And even jackrabbits hid in their burrows. Rattlesnakes appeared briefly, then had to seek shade to protect their body temperature. And those few buffalo that had survived the onslaught of commercial teams wandered aimless among the bleached skeletons of their brothers. It was a huge concentration of Indians that gathered in the various canyons of Palo Duro as a last defense against the approaching army. Kicking Bird and his 1,000 Kiowa, White Antelope and his many Cheyenne, Matark and his 900 Comanche. They did not fight as a combined army. Indian custom would never permit that kind of effective coalition. But they did support one another, and to rout them out of their protective furrows was going to be difficult. On came the 5 columns, with Miles and McKenzie always supplying the pressure. But as they approached Palo Duro, the ordeals of a Texas September began to take a heavy toll, and as water supplies diminished, the men learned the agony of thirst. When Reed's 10th Cavalry ran completely out of anything to drink, Jaxifer, acting on his own, ordered one of his men to kill a horse so that his troops could at least wet their lips with its blood. And after Reed's infantry, lagging far behind, suffered for 2 days of staggering thirst, he ordered his men to take their knives and open veins in their arms so that their own blood could sustain them. When some demurred, he showed them how, by cutting into his own arm, then offering it to 2 soldiers while he pumped his fist to make the blood spurt. One of the men fainted. Texas weather, particularly on the plains, could provide wild variations. And in mid-September, at the height of the heat and the drought, a blue norther swept in, and during one daylight period, the thermometer dropped from 99 degrees to 39. For 2 days, the freezing wind blew, threatening the lives of men who had been sweating their health away, and on the third day, torrential rains engulfed the entire area. Now, the war became a chase through mud, with the sturdier, slower horses of the cavalry having an advantage. From all sides, the blueclads began to compress the thousands of Indians. And although the latter, under the expert guidance of chiefs like Matark, succeeded in avoiding pitched battles, they could not escape the punishing effect of the swift cavalry raids, the burning of lodges, and the destruction of crops. Their most serious defeat came on a day when they lost only 4 braves. In drenching rain, Mackenzie and Reed found a defile on the face of the canyon wall, and with great daring led their cavalry down that steep and almost impassable route. When they reached the canyon floor, they found a concentration of Chief Mamanti's Kiowa, Ohomatai's stubborn Comanche, and Iron Shirt's Cheyenne. Thundering through the Indian camps, they scattered the enemy and burned all their lodges. But with even more devastating effect, they captured their entire herd of horses and mules, 1,424 in number. With practiced eye, Mackenzie rode through the animals, selecting about 370 of the best, then gave Reed an extraordinary command, "Kill the rest." When Reed relayed this to Jaxifer, the big black man who loved horses and who tended his own as if they were his children objected. But Reed said, "It's an order." And the black troops carried it out, while from a distance the captured Indian chiefs looked on in horror. Never did Mackenzie's troops, or any from the other 4 columns, engage the Indians in a pitched battle. But the despair they spread through the Indian camps, with their incessant burning of villages and routing of camps and slaughter of horses, convinced the enemy that sustained resistance was going to be impossible. And it was a Kiowa chief named Woman's Heart who made the first gesture. Assembling 35 of his principal braves, he told them, "We can no longer hold them off. Get your families." The men supposed that they were about to make a gallant last stand. Instead, when the large group was assembled, he told them, "We shall ride to Camp Hope. To attack it, there'll be soldiers. No, to surrender to the agent there. This day we start for the reservation that will be our home hereafter." And while women wept, and braves stared at the canyon walls, which had for so many decades been their protection, Woman's Heart led his Kiowa away. Soon, Stone Calf and Bull Bear of the Cheyenne, accompanied by 820 of their warriors, straggled into the reservations, as did White Horse and 200 of his Comanche, and Kicking Bird and Lone Wolf, with almost 500 of their Kiowa. What gunfire had been unable to accomplish was achieved by remorseless pressure and destruction. The backbone of Indian resistance had been broken by the irresistible courage of the young colonels, Miles and Mackenzie, and their men.